Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome to today's segment of Afternoon Satsang. Today is supposed to be the day when we take up a general theme. Last week we had taken up the theme on Darshan. And even as Prem and myself were thinking about what theme we should pick up, it suddenly struck us that the 23rd of November, Bhagwan's birthday, happens to be a Thursday this time. And it will be a wonderful opportunity for us to have the afternoon satsang on Bhagwan's birthday. And if we go as per our schedule, the birthday fortnight would be the fortnight for the Bhagavata Vahini. On Swami's birthday, we wanted to discuss only and solely the Sai Bhagavatam and not any other Bhagavatam, however sweet and endearing and charming Bhagwan Krishna or Bhagwan Rama might be. And therefore, Prem and myself thought that we would advance the Bhagavata Vahini fortnight by 1 week. And therefore, today, as well as the next week, we will be doing the Bhagavata Vahini so that we can feast on the glories and stories and sweet memories of our beloved Bhagwan on the birthday day, that is the 23rd of November. And so therefore, it is my privilege and pleasure to welcome you all in offering our most humble salutations at the lotus feet of our beloved Bhagwan as we start today's Bhagavata Vahini Satsang. Sairam Prem.
Sairam Arvind, and really it doesn't happen often that Swami's birthday falls on a Thursday and we have the opportunity, as we have mentioned many times before, you know, the Bhagavatam is actually about God, but still for us, the stories of Swami is a little more dearer than any other avatar and any other manifestation, and it's rightly so. As I recall a beautiful incident which Professor Nanjundaya once narrated, mm-hmm. when there was a Kavi Sammelan in Swami's presence.
I think a gathering of poets.
Yeah, a gathering of poets, and these were real poets. You know, not the Kavi Sammelan we used to have with students like us reciting poetry in front of Swami. You know, these were like the best of the best Telugu poets were called from different parts of Andhra Pradesh, and they had this presentation in front of Swami. And they were phenomenal. You know, they were masters in the art. You could give them any word and they will make a poem out of it. You can give them any theme and tell them in this meter and they can make, you know, very, very scholarly people. So they all had this array of poets reciting their poetry, and all was on Swami. So Professor Nanjundaya was there, and he was so thrilled, because as a person who understands the language, and of course as a person who's so devoted to Swami, he found that, you know, that was such an exciting thing for him. And he had the opportunity of going to Swami's presence after the public gathering was over. So he went up to Swami and he was all emotional and choked up, and he said, Swami, such a beautiful program. It was so nice and all that. But he found that Swami was not as enthusiastic as he was. Mm. And then Swami went on to say, actually, I didn't like it so much, Swami said.
Oh my God, why?
And he said, Swami, how can it be? It was so nice, Swami said. Swami said, if you like it, you'll be happy with it. I'm not happy with it. And then Swami said, see, these are poets. They are literary scholars, and this is their art. So they can make up this poetry on anybody. It's not necessarily on Swami. You know, they are very good at the play of words. And so what they displayed was their talent and was their art. But it was not out of their experience. It was not out of their feeling. And then Swami said, "That why do you think that all these silly poetry which these boys write for me, I celebrate it so much and I relish it so much? Because it comes from true feeling and comes from experience. You know, when they write a poem saying that, oh, Swami is our mother, it comes out of experience. And it's not merely an expression of talent." And so true it is, because why are we able to relate to Swami's stories more? It's because our feeling is there. You know, when we say that Swami did this, Swami did that, or that person spoke like this, got angry like this, I think to a great extent we all can relate to that. And that Bhagavatam of sharing Swami's stories is any day more special than however sweet the stories of Krishna are. I'm sorry, Mr. Parikshit, I have no clue how sweet Swami's stories are.
You know, you have just triggered me something that happened just an hour ago. There is this school girl from Kerala, Cochin. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting. She had mailed me about a month or so ago. And in brief, her story is like this. She was like any other child. going to school and call and preparing for college and all that, when she came across some articles and blogs on Swami and she began to read, she got interested in Swami, and she says just reading the different stories of different devotees with Swami spurred her so much that it built up a great love for Bhagwan in her. She has not seen Swami. She was not even aware of Swami till he was physically present on the face of the earth. You know, that is the kind of background she's hailing from. But she found herself falling in love with Swami and kept reading more and more and all that. But it was restricted to only her. And in some time, she got to know that her father had suffered a cardiac stroke and he was in need of a bypass surgery. The prospects looked very grim and very bleak, and the father was very upset, the mother was worried, her elder sister was worried, everybody was so tense. And in that tension, this little girl goes up and says that nothing is going to happen because Swami is there to take care. You know, Swami is the Hridaya Nivasi. She starts speaking all these words which doesn't make so much sense to them at that point in time. But, you know, that is the magical thing about devotion and faith. It may not make logical sense to someone, but it is definitely perceived. So the entire family, the father, the mother, the sister, they were very impressed and amazed by this girl's faith and, you know, confidence and all this. She had in the mail written to me asking whether you can share your phone number so that my father can speak with you. And when I had actually called the father, he was all curious to know about Swami. He said, who is this Swami? You know, my daughter swears by him. She is so transformed. She is doing this. He's praising his daughter so much. And he's telling all this because of this Swami. I know, I'm very enthused. And I don't know, somehow I'm feeling that I can go through the surgery, let the doctor say anything. Nothing is going to happen. So I just didn't know. I was just feeling happy about the conviction and faith and devotion that his daughter was exuding. So I just said, yes sir, Swami is God for me, for many people around the world, and when you take him as God, Swami says that with faith nothing ever goes wrong, Swami is always there. So some normal words like that. And today this entire family lands up in Prashanthi Nilayam. They are coming to Puttaparthi for the first time. And when I met this uncle, is hale and hearty. He said he went through the surgery, he's recuperated, everything is fine, he's fantastic, and he credits the entire thing to Swami. And he said that when this happened, my daughter came and said, I had promised Swami that you make my father's heart whole, I will ensure that we come and offer our salutations to you. And because when she told this, I am convinced that it is Swami who did this. So therefore, the first thing we have done is we have come. They have landed in the middle of the night yesterday, around 2 a.m. or 3 a.m. taken up lodging in Prashanthi Puttaparthi and had morning darshan today, and they were beaming with so much of thrill and joy. And you know, when I met them, that joy and thrill came into my heart also, because it made me realize that though we have so much attachment for that lovable form which we feel we can't see anymore, that name, that form, that power is pervading all around the world in its own manner, picking up devotees, filling their heart with ananda, filling their heart with devotion, and giving many people the chance to experience what bhakti can do. So it is indeed thrilling. The Sai Bhagavatam is not endless simply because the amount of things, number of things Swami has done is so much that we can't capture them. It is endless simply because it continues to happen every day, every hour, every moment.
And absolutely, you know, come to think of it, it's really a paradox in that sense. We completely value the time we spent in Swami's physical proximity. I mean, nothing can replace that. We really, that's probably the best part of our life, and you know, anything can be given to go back to that. But having said that, you also know that that's not everything. You know, from a story like this, you know that Swami can reach out to people, and that's the leveling agent, or that's how the whole thing is set. Everybody is put equally in that sense, because you might be serving Swami in Swami's room, or you might be sitting in some corner in the globe, but your access to Swami is the same. That's something which our mind actually does not realize. The access to Swami was the same. Same is the case whether you were born before 1926 or between 1926 and 2011 or much after that. The access to Swami is still the same. And in fact, probably the whole of Bhagavata Vahini, I think Shuka Maharishi is trying to convince Parikshit that that, you know, don't think that you've come late and don't feel bad that you have not been worthy enough of that proximity of Lord Krishna. You are definitely worthy. I think what we spoke of a couple of weeks back was that. Vyasa had said that to Parikshit. Now, Sukha Maharshi is also reiterating the same thing, saying that you definitely qualify to receive, everybody qualifies to receive the grace of the Lord. You just have to make that attempt.
Yes, make that attempt, that effort, that penance, that tapas. In fact, that is what Shuka and Parikshit discuss next. Because Shuka is now trying to explain to Parikshit something which is impossible to explain. He later himself admits that this is very complicated, it just cannot be explained. But still, Shuka begins to make efforts to attempt to explain this, that is, the process of creation. And even as creation began, you know, even as Shuka starts saying about how Brahma began by creating Brahma or Maya, delusion, illusion. This is the medium for creation, right? So that is the molding clay. Just like a director starts to write a story, it starts with imagination. It is all illusory, it's not real. That is the way even the divine drama begins. So as Brahma created Brahma as the medium for creation, even as he began the creation, Shuka says that he heard a voice from above. You know, some voice from above. It is multiple in meaning. One is directly the above. The other, it shows that there is some power higher than Brahma also. So Brahma hears a voice which emphasizes that the essential base for your entire creation is going to be this tapas. Tapas is going to be the base for the entire creation. And even as Shuka says this, you know, it is amazing because even now when we spoke about all these incidents, everything, we realize that irrespective of everything else, what matters is the effort that we put in, the tapas, the penance that we do. And that is a statement that had been made even before Brahma began creation. Brahma heard a voice which said that tapas is the essential base for everything. And it is at this point that our curious cat, our dear Parikshit, asks Sage Shuka, what is the meaning of this tapas? You know, he interrupts him before he can go on and dilate about creation. He just interrupts him and says, Sage, revered sir, please tell me, what is this tapas? And that is when Sage Shuka begins an elaborate exposition on what tapas is. The first point he says is tapas is nothing but sadhana, discipline and spiritual exercise.
Right, and the basis of that whole explanation is, you know, what he is saying, that it has all started with the substratum of Maya. The delusion is the basis in which the whole creation has come about. And if this tapas is not done, one is caught up in this, within this this cycle of Maya itself. Mm. You don't look beyond it. And he says to look beyond it, you will have to withdraw the senses, the intellect and the mind. That's the explanation Shuka Maharshi gives. The senses, mind and intellect are forever turning outward, and the process of turning them inward, which will eventually lead you to looking beyond this Maya and looking at self-realization, that process is called tapas.
And you know, interestingly, if you look at it, this tapas has all the three aspects. When they say sadhana, discipline and spiritual exercise, you know, it's almost like physical, mental as well as spiritual exercise, all three. Because the discipline is possibly physical, sadhana is possibly mental, and definitely the third term used is spiritual exercise. Just like, you know, when I do a physical exercise, when I do push-ups, when I lift weights or anything that I do, I feel some kind of physical pain, but it builds strength in me. In the same way, when I do disciplining of the mind, when I do control on my desires, when I abstain from something, when I focus on something and I ensure that I don't focus on something else, all these are mental exercises which again causes some kind of difficulty and at a mental level, but they again empower us and strengthen us. And finally, definitely spiritual exercise also, which is something that takes us closer and closer, which is essential, because even though it might cause momentary pain or grief, it is essential to take us higher. So all these three are necessary. In fact, the voice tells Shuka tells Parikshit that tapas is what ensures creation, sustenance and destruction as well. which means Brahma, Vishnu and Maheshwara are also able to do what they do because of their tapas. I mean, that I think really places tapas at a very high pedestal.
It goes back to that point where he says that this is the moment where Brahma is creating. It's almost like it's like the secret code which has been put in everything. I mean, as I was saying, that the access to God is the same who you are, where you are, whatever you are doing. It doesn't have to be that you have to be in a place like Prashanthi Nilayam doing God's work. It doesn't mandate any of those things, because inherent in creation itself, this concept of tapas is there, that he or she who turns within in search of divine will be able to find it wherever he is. That's why he says in creation. And, you know, in sustenance, we always say that, Swami would say this, that sadhana is not only for progress. We always think of it that way, that when you do sadhana, you have to keep progressing every day, and every day you have to move closer to God. Sometimes you do sadhana even to maintain what you have already got.
To prevent a fall.
Right, to prevent a fall, to prevent a slide. And that is what is the importance of sustenance also being sustained by the idea of tapas. And then finally dissolution, because that's the whole idea. Unless the maya is dissolved, you don't go beyond it eventually.
In fact, you know, I'm going a little ahead, because later on, Shuka describes the 10 essential features of every Purana. In that, actually, this is mentioned, you know, there are the 8th and 9th aspects are called Nirodha and Mukti.
Mm-hmm.
And the only difference between the two is, for those that pursue the material world, the conclusion comes as Nirodha. Nirodha means destruction, dissolution, what we call as Pralaya.
Okay.
And for those who pursue God and the Godward path, the end comes as Moksha. So it is the same end, but depending on what you have pursued, it results either in Nirodha or Pralaya. Otherwise, it results in Moksha or Mukti. So you see, that is where the importance of tapas comes in, because Shuka tells Parikshit that in tapas what you do is, you rein in the senses, mind and intellect, which is forever chasing things outward. For example, the ear hears a sound and the eyes see where the sound is coming from. The mind decides that I want it. The intellect devises a way to get it. And you go and start in its pursuit. So forever the senses are dragging you outward. Tapas is the process by which you force your intellect, your mind and your senses to turn inward and explore the universe within. So therefore, it is very, very vital, because, as I said, later on it comes, it makes all the difference between meeting an end in terms of the worldly sense, that is Pralaya, where it just gets destroyed and reborn and rebirth, or you go beyond the cycle of life and death and this whole cycle of creation itself and become one with the Creator. And the thing that makes the difference between these two is tapas.
Right. And I recall another point which Swami would often make. You know, when you do any kind of sadhana, any kind of spiritual activity, Swami would say it's meant for bringing about chitta shuddhi, or the purification of the mind and the inner instruments. But Swami would often say that that is not the ultimate end. I mean, that is like, you know, when you start off an experiment in your chemistry lab, you first get all your apparatus cleaned up and ready, right? But that's not the end of the experiment. Actually, that's the beginning of the experiment. So Swami says that sadhana is chitta shuddhi. The attainment of chitta shuddhi is only the beginning of the spiritual journey. And Swami says finally the sublimation of the antakarnas, where even the ego, that sense that I am a separate entity, vanishes. So that is, I think that's the important point of tapas being the source of destruction too. And as you very beautifully said, it's not the destruction of the kind that we fear, but it's the ultimate destruction, which is the sublimation which you're trying to achieve through this whole process.
That is the goal of tapas, explains Sage Shuka to Parikshit. He says that one must get independence or Swarajya. This is so beautiful. This term is very dear to my heart, because I remember Swami explaining this in the only interview that I had got before the, coincidentally, the Independence Day drama. So when it was the Independence Day drama that was being put up, Swami was explaining what is meant by independence. And Swami stated that independence doesn't mean the freedom to do whatever you want. You can't swing your hand and say it's my freedom to swing my hand if it's going to hit somebody else's head. But Swami said, independence means independence, to depend on what is within and not have any external dependencies. I mean, if we just look at it, forever in our life, we are depending on things external to us only, for everything. Even for the air we breathe, we depend on the air that is outside, you know. And Swami would say, true independence comes when you are dependent on only what is within. And for that, the term used in Sanskrit is Swarajya. And Swami again explained that Swarajya is loosely translated as self-rule. But Swami said that self stands for a capital S, self, which is the Atma within. And it is only when the Atma is ruling, when the Atma is primal, it is the first priority, that is when you can call yourself as truly independent or truly free. And that is precisely what Sage Shuka also explains to Parikshit, that the goal of tapas is independence or Swarajya. It helps you to realize that everything is transient and the relationship between God and the world is like that of a relationship between the dream and the dreamer. The moment, you know, then the dream goes, you don't cry saying that, oh God, everything got destroyed. It just, the dream becomes part of the dreamer when the dreamer wakes up. It is the tapas that helps a person to wake up.
But you know, it's these kind of analogies which actually cause a little bit of confusion, the dreamer and the dream. It is conveying that idea very beautifully, but it also gives rise to other questions. Just like every other analogy, like, you know, I think we're going to come to that point where Brahma as an entity is born. You're talking about, let's say you're saying that Brahma is the first one to be born. Then you say that he's sitting on a lotus. So did the lotus come before Brahma?
Or, and that lotus comes from the navel of Vishnu.
So the concept of a navel, you cannot talk of a concept of a navel without talking of a human body. Mm. Right? But these are all representative of an idea which we can relate to. Because when you say that he is of this body, you can relate to that. If you say that he has four heads, we know what it is to see a person with one head, and we're able to relate to an idea of a four-headed person, considering that, you know, he sees in all the directions, that sort of a thing. So same is the case with this idea of a dream and a dreamer, where a dreamer creates the dream, as Swami would give another analogy, where the spider makes the web from itself and it swallows the web itself. Mm-hmm. But when you say a dream and a dreamer, you're talking of a situation where a person is not in control of what he is creating in the form of a dream, where a person is led a certain kind of a life in the wakeful state, and that starts reflecting in the dream state. And that's why immediately Parikshit asks, how can this be the way the creation is related to the creator? Because it means that there is something which is outside of this dream, and the moment you talk of a wakeful state for God, then you're talking of other entities being present in that, and that influencing the dream. So he says, how can he be a dreamer, and how can the whole creation be his dream?
Exactly, and one can understand his doubts also, because when I am dreaming, I, as you said, I don't have control of things happening in my dream. So when God is the dreamer also, I mean, when God comes as an avatar, that is what Bhagavatam is about. So, when he comes as an avatar, it means that he is taking a role in that drama, which means he is becoming a part of that dream. So, Parikshit's question is, in my dream, you know, when I am actually being burnt by fire, or though he doesn't express it that way, but his doubt is exactly that when I am wet by water, when I am burnt by fire in my dream, I feel that. I feel everything. I don't feel that, hey, this is just a dream, nothing will happen, till I wake up. So his question is, does God also undergo that delusion then? I mean, when he comes in the dream, is he also bound by the dream, just like I am bound by the dream when I am in the dream? And the next question that he asks is also very interesting. He says that, you say that the dream is an illusion, but how can the dream be an illusion? Because mostly what I see in the dream are things that I've consciously or subconsciously registered in my waking state. So all those things have some basis in the real world. So it is not that it's 100% illusory also. So these are the doubts that confound Parikshit, as they confound any one of us who listen to them.
Right. The reason why this analogy of a dream and dreamer, of course, it's an example which would come multiple times in Vedanta itself. And that's again an important thing, why the concepts of Vedanta are told in this form, even in the Bhagavata Purana. There's an explanation coming for that later. But this concept of a dream and a dreamer is very relevant, because you talk of the created not having any substance at all. And though when you talk of a dreamer, as you're saying, it's about a person without having a control over what he has created, but the essence of that analogy is the created does not have a basis at all. It completely relies on the creator. The moment the creator wishes to wake up from that dream or wake up from that play of creation, it ends. It does not have an existence of its own at all. But that's where its role ends.
The analogy ends.
To make it even more clear, now Vyasa gives, Shuka Maharshi gives another analogy, which probably, complements this analogy of a dream and a dreamer, where he says it's like a person who writes a play, who creates a drama, who creates a skit with actors. And as we've used this analogy many times in our discussion before, it's a very strong one, because when a director creates a play, when he writes a play and he assigns that to characters, he is giving them emotions which is not their own. He's saying that, okay, you are the villain, so you will be angry, and you're the hero, so you're very compassionate, and so and so will play this role, and this will be the emotion.
A character sketch is drawn.
Exactly.
And interestingly, it's not like everything is black and white also in the drama.
Right.
There are areas where it's a mixture of everything. And that is how in the divine creation, in Maya, where we have these three gunas of sattva, rajas and tamas, where you may not find somebody 100% tamas or 100% sattvic, but different mixes of the same three. That is how the roles are assigned in the drama too.
Right, and then that's what he says, that it's like a drama who's a writer who's creating this drama, and what does he use? He uses the emotions of the three gunas in different proportions, and it is completely his will. He's saying that, but I think had he given this analogy before, then again it comes to, if he is having a drama and having characters, where do those individuals come who play the character? You know, you're already talking about a certain advanced stage in creation. You're not starting at the initial stage of creation. And that's why the analogies are limited. And that's why together they complement each other and they give a better idea of creation, what Shuka Maharshi is trying to convey.
I think, you know, to give my own example, if you're trying to describe a car to a person who has never seen a car, you say that it moves fast like a horse. Then if he asks, where is the tail? No, it doesn't have a tail. Then it has a boot. What's a boot? A boot is like a box where you keep your clothes. Oh, then the box doesn't... I mean, this is how right. It is. When I'm trying to describe something that cannot be described to a person who has not experienced it, I will use multiple analogies, but each analogy is restricted only to that aspect, and we cannot extend it beyond and then get into doubts.
Right, and that is why, you know, if you look at Vedanta, I think we had spoken about this a couple of weeks back, what Vedanta speaks of as pramanas, that, you know, the pratyaksha pramana. I think one of the discourses which we had during the Dashara celebration, Swami speaks about that.
Pratyaksha pramana is what I have seen.
Seen directly. Then you have anumana pramana, which you come to conclude based on some of the inferences which you have. Then there is a shabda pramana, based on what you hear from people who have seen it themselves. And I think there is a upamana pramana, which is a little more a derivation based on much fewer inputs that you have. Not exactly.
I think upamana pramana is, if there is analogies, a smoke, actually, there has to be a fire.
That is anumana. Upamana is like analogies, just like you're saying.
Okay.
That if you have to describe something, you give a simile or a metaphor. To explain it. And Vedanta says that almost nothing can be understood by any one of this. You will have to use all of them to understand a concept which you're not able to understand through pratyaksha pramana. You have to go through all of this, and that's why, I mean, something as complex as the creation, as Swami beautifully says, you cannot lift the rock that you're standing upon, right? So it is like this, you are in the dream, you will never be able to understand the dream and the dreamer completely. There is always that limitation.
I just feel that when you read all the great treatises or things that try to explain this, almost all of them come up with like similar analogies and examples.
True.
So I feel when somebody is aspiring to reach that, these analogies will look quite confusing and one pitted against the other, everything, and you'll wonder, how do I this? This is just my line of thinking. And as you put in more and more effort, finally it's your own experience that has to teach you. By God's grace, by luck, by effort, by whatever, once you get that experience, everything becomes so crystal clear to you.
Right.
And then now when somebody comes and asks you, you go back to the same analogies because that is the best metaphor that you have to substitute for the experience.
Only thing is you will be narrating it with a much
much greater joy and you will
understanding
be seeing, and also you will get compassion. See, now as intellectuals, when we talk, when we pit your metaphor against mine, we may possibly fight because we are at an intellectual level. But when a realized one speaks, he's able to empathize with the confusion that is that's happening in the other person's mind because he possibly has gone through that, unless he's an avatar and it is a descent. But any sadhaka, any aspirant who has achieved it, he's able to understand and empathize it. That's why the masters are able to teach us with our own analogies. You know, whatever analogy we pick up itself, they will perfect it, make us think deeper into that and achieve it instead of getting into argumentation.
And, absolutely. That's what is the importance of this concept of tapas which he's talking about. Because, you know, in Vedas it is said, yato vacho nivartante apraapya manasasa. I mean, that's given as a rider. Before you start the process itself, don't worry, your mind cannot comprehend it. Even if you manage to see it, you cannot speak about it because it's beyond speech and it's beyond rational. That's what it is told, but then you are told to think about it. Then you're told to wonder about it, inquire about it, because that is the process of tapas. And through that process, you discard these instruments which are actually limitations in themselves. And that is why the tapas, the process is important. It's not like by sitting and reading you will reach it, by sitting and inquiring you will reach it, but that process itself will enable you to reach it at some point in time.
It's like this quantum chemistry, you know, or not quantum chemistry, quantum mechanics.
Physicists will come after it.
Quantum mechanics. Let me say it that way. So in this quantum, it is, I think, one of the foremost fathers of quantum mechanics only, the quantum principles. I don't remember his name, but he said something to the effect that the more you dive into quantum, the more you realize that the less you know. Right. That's how it is. And when you said yato vacho nivartante apraapya manasaha, it's almost like that. It's just like that. The more you discover, the less you know. That's how it is. And it is paradoxical, but with that one experience, everything gets cleared, and therefore, all our life, all our activities, all our thoughts, all our words must be towards that direction of getting that experience. And all that we do, physically, mentally, and spiritually, in order to get that, all that is covered by this term called tapas. And that is the explanation Shuka Maharshi gives Parikshit before he can ask his next question. And before he can ask his next question, we'll take a little break, dear listeners. Don't go anywhere. On the other side of the break, we will continue with these questions of Parikshit and the enlightening and interesting answers by Shuka Maharshi.
Thank you.
Welcome back, dear listeners. Going back to the conversation which Shukumar Rishi and Parikshit are having, as we said, in fact, last time when we were speaking about this conversation, we spoke of the series of questions that Parikshit raises. And this whole discussion is actually in response to that. I mean, this immediate discussion. We know
series
that.
Series of apparently disconnected questions.
Right, apparently disconnected questions, but all of them really deep ones. And relevant. So in the course of answering them, this is the discussion which comes up where Shikamar, she starts talking about the basis of the entire creation, where we know that the whole thing comes about on the basis of Maya and delusion. But this point of tapas being the basis of everything, where the key to dissolve this dissolution is delusion, is put in the aspect of creation itself through the process of tapas.
And then, you know, Shuka Maharshi begins to speak about creation as such. And as you said, it comes about, he says that in the beginning how from the navel of Lord Vishnu came a lotus, and in that lotus was Brahma. And this Brahma was the Chaturmukha Brahma, the four-headed Brahma. It's very interesting because I read another story which said that once Brahma goes to visit Krishna, and Krishna is considered as the supreme Godhead. So Brahma goes to visit Krishna and he stopped at the door and he asked for an introduction. So he tells, "I am Brahma." And now this attendant goes in, comes out, and then he says, which Brahma are you? Brahma is infuriated. He's saying, "What do you mean, which Brahma? I am the Brahma, the creator." And he, in a huff, he walks in. That is when he ends up in an assembly hall where he sees hundreds and thousands of Brahmas standing there. And he is just one among them. And Krishna welcomes him saying, Chaturmukha Brahma, come in. Chaturmukha Brahma meaning the Brahma with four heads. But that is also not some unique name for him, because he sees that there are multiple Chaturmukha Brahmas, four-faced Brahmas, four-headed Brahmas. There are many of them. And then he goes on to see there are Brahmas with multiple kinds of heads and multiple of such Brahmas. And it is, in that story, it said that the Brahma with the highest number of heads had 108 heads. You know, this is the kind of meeting that this Brahma walks into. that is when he realizes that there are multiple Brahmas. This is just one world. There are multiple Brahmas, and the number of heads signify the number of dimensions. This world has four dimensions, that is the length, breadth, height and time. Of course, it moves along the axis of time, and therefore it is said that this world, this creation has a four-headed Brahma. So there is a universe with 108 dimensions, and there are multiple such universes, and this is all the Brahmas coming there. And so therefore it gets very, 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 very complicated. And that is what even Sage Shuka tells Parikshit, that see, don't try to understand creation from this explanation because it's too complicated. But I'll assure you this much, that whatever you have asked the questions, they're all well within the framework of the Puranas that I'm going to narrate to you. So you need not worry about it, because those questions will be answered by the Puranas. And when it comes to the question of creation, it's too complicated. You just leave trying to understand it. Whatever you need to know, I have told you that much. That's enough. And when he says this, so Parikshit immediately begins by saying, wow, Puranas. What are the Puranas? You know, it's almost like any term or anything that Shuka says, Parikshit wants to know what they are. And so here, Shuka Maharshi says that the Puranas have all the answers that you want. And therefore, Parikshit's natural next question is, wow, so what are these Puranas supposed to be?
You know, even as you are narrating that incident of the multiple Brahmas, and then that's the beauty. If you go into the Puranas, if you go into Shiva Purana, they will talk of Shiva being the ultimate. You know, you have that story of Shiva becoming the pillar of light,
and
Brahma and Vishnu trying to fathom the beginning and the end. Mm-hmm. And they say that he is the Supreme Lord. And then, of course, you have the Vishnu Purana, which talks about how everything comes from the navel of Lord Vishnu. If you go to the Devi Puranam, they talk about how Tripura Sundari being the overlord is not the word, the mother of all creation, including the Trinity. And the thing is, we listen to all of this and accept all of this. In fact, I'm not getting the name. Who is that famous German philosopher whom Swami used to often
Max quote? Müller?
Max Müller. He would say that is what is the speciality of Indian culture and Bharatiya tradition. There's a word for that. They call it henotheism, I think. Mm. Right? Henotheism is you accept that there are multiple deities, but you pick up one and you worship that deity as the ultimate.
As the one and only.
As the one and only, and the ultimate power. And you're perfectly comfortable with somebody else picking up any other deity and worshipping that deity as the ultimate. I mean, you do not fight about it, you do not disagree, or you just kind of, you're fine with that. Because it's only enough, I mean, it's like, as we were telling once, you know, you want to get to the core of the earth. It's not that you have to dig only in India. You can dig from America, you can dig from the North Pole, South Pole. But if your direction is inward, you always come to the center. And it's such an acceptable thing that you can pick up any of these forms, man, woman, animal, half animal, and you can believe that to be the ultimate form and the source of all creation. And that's the beauty of Bharatiya tradition itself.
And in fact, I'm reminded of the analogy that Swami would often quote in his discourses. He would say that some people like Mysore Pak, some people like Jalebi. You know, if you ask me, I will say that this sweet is the best in the world. But if you come and tell me, no, actually this sweet is the best in the world, I have no problem with that, you have no problem with this. I feel it is as simple as that when I say that this is the supreme being. For me, Bhagwan Shri Satya Sai Baba is the supreme deity. In fact, I feel all the other deities, wherever I go to, Rama, Krishna, Shiva, Jesus, Buddha, whoever, everybody, I feel is subservient to Swami. I feel like that. Even if I go to the temples, I feel it is them, it is Swami there in these different forms. These are all different forms that Swami has donned. Somebody else may come and say, no, Swami is just one part, one of the different forms of Krishna. And that doesn't offend me. And I'm sure what I'm saying will not offend him. I think that is something very, very beautiful about this Bharatiya culture, the broad-mindedness, which I just hope that in this modern deluge of things that India is getting into, this broad-based Bharatiya culture is never forgotten.
And absolutely. It should not become the offense in the name of defense. That's what happens, as they were saying. Swami would say that is what has happened to our nuclear proliferation. in the name of maintaining peace, we are only, you know, going on arming ourselves with even more deadlier weapons.
And Swami would laugh saying, they say that 5 such weapons are capable of destroying the entire earth. Why do you want 5,000 of them then?
Right. I mean, that's the hypocrisy. But coming back to this concept which you just introduced of the Puranas, the moment Shukamarshi says Puranas, Parikshit's, you know, ears become all attention. He says, what are these Puranas? And this is very important because, you know, again, when you talk of Bharatiya tradition, it is filled with Puranas. There's so many Puranas, and I don't think we'll be able to list them because they, for everything there's a Purana. There's, a, you know, Garuda Purana, Skanda Purana, they say, and many, many Puranas. And sometimes Swami would say that many of these Puranas are like works of fiction written by probably well-natured authors, to put it in the most mildest way. Not all of them have that status of a Purana which can be sworn by. Many of these Puranas are, you know, just like an analogy, like, you know, just to explain a spiritual concept, I come up with an analogy and I put it forth. There are many, many great noble souls who in the interest of trying to share a spiritual concept, they put it in the form of a story, and that story probably would have characters like Lord Shiva and Parvati and some of the other demigods which we come across in the other Puranas. And sometimes, apparently, when Swami was talking to some students, Swami made this point. He said, yeah, sometimes these Puranas written by people as human as anybody else, that on a day when he would have woken up and Swami had said this, that if he has not had a fight with his wife, he will talk, he will write in that Purana about the glory of Grihastha life. And some other day he would have a fight with her and he would say that detachment is the glorious path to, you know, self-realization. Swami says that's why you would find some inconsistencies. But Shukamarshi says that, you know, there are many, many stories like that, but among them there are few which are worthy of reverence, and that is what he's going to talk about.
And he says 18 of them are what his father, that is Vyasa himself, collated, and those are the 18 great Puranas that we have. You know, this might arouse a question in any listener's mind as to whether the Puranas are true then. So these are all just stories then. They are not true. Instead of getting into that debate, you know, I would like to talk about fairy tales. The stories from the Panchatantra about monkeys and crocodiles and hippos and deer talking to each other and some plotting and some scheming, the others saving and all this. Are they true? We are convinced that they are not true, right? Yet we go on teaching them to our children. Why are we teaching to our children stuff that is not true? I do hope that we continue to teach to our children the Panchatantra, the Hitopadesha, all these stories, fairy tales. We know fairy tales, in fact the term fairy tales itself means things that are not true, that are imagination. That's how it is, its usage is in English. And yet, we expose our children to fairy tales, we expose our children to Santa Claus. Why do we do all this? Because though they might be imaginary, though they might be stories, there is something very profoundly good that they embody. They are imaginary possibly in the physical realm, but in terms of the message, in terms of the import that they carry, they are very much real and very much necessary and beneficial. That's the reason we keep them alive. I feel that is the same kind of courtesy and leniency we should extend towards the Puranas also.
Right.
Instead of trying to go into whether that lady existed, this man existed, we should focus on the eternal principles that they are trying to embody, because that is what they are. That's what Shuka says. Shuka says that it is not everybody's cup of tea to read the Vedas, to understand the Vedas. In fact, in a discourse that I was hearing that Bhagwan delivered, I think in 1987, that is what Swami says. Swami says that Vedas are it's not possible for everybody to fathom the Vedas, because you need to put in tremendous effort and you know, dedicate an entire lifetime for it. Even then you may not be able to achieve it, but that is the minimum qualification that you have to do. That is the kind of thing that is there in the Vedas. these terse truths and maxims and aphorisms that are embodied there. Those things are elaborated and made easily digestible, palatable to us through the Puranas.
In fact, you know, when we talk about sage Bharadwaja, we know that connection of Shiva Shakti and Swami's narrating that incident, I think 1963 during the Guru Purnima. The whole idea of him doing that penance was so that he can get an extension of 100 years so that he can comprehend the Vedas. That's how the story of Bharadwaj Muni goes, that he keeps seeking extension of hundreds and hundreds of years so that he can completely understand the Vedas, and finally Brahma and Vishnu tell him that it's not possible. You are, you know, attempting.
I think somebody comes and points out to him a small piece of rock and says, if those four mountains are the Vedas, that small rock is what you've got till now.
Right, what you've got till now, and there is no, it's not possible. And that is why the Puranas come, and, you know, going back to that debate of are they true, are they you know, completely fictional, it's very difficult to say, because, you know, we know how the Ramayana and Mahabharata themselves were written. Ramayana was written when it was happening, and Valmiki was one of the characters in the Ramayana itself, right? It is partially happening in front of him, but it is something which he sees in his mind's eye. So is it true or is it fictional? Will you say that it is an imagination of an author? Of course, he has not seen it himself. He has not seen the events happening in Lanka or the events happening in Ayodhya. But it were happening when he was in his own lifetime.
Almost like a live broadcast he was watching.
Right. So similarly, even the Mahabharata was like that. Vyasa was one of the important characters in the Mahabharata itself.
He's one of the forefathers of the Pandavas and Kauravas.
Right, and he's the one who composed it. So will you say that as his work of literature or something which really happened? And that is the case with all the Puranas, because you don't know where that line is between reality and imagination. And as you're saying that it's no point in going into that, as long as they are conveying the message which they meant to convey, and they're conveying the message of Vedanta, as Swami said, because it is not directly available to the normal minds.
And so Sage Shuka begins to explain about the Puranas, and he says, there are 10 common characteristics in the Puranas. See, the entire Bhagavatam, it describes basically the various incarnations of Bhagwan, of God. And the process of these, and in the process of these descriptions, there are 10 different subject matters that get explained. 10 different, so these are 10 characteristics that are found in every Purana. And these are the 10 characteristics that Sage Shuka is about to explain to Parikshit. But before explaining these characteristics itself, you know, it is definitely Swami telling us, because Swami is putting it through Shuka's words, but he says that, see, it is like the different steps in the process of obtaining butter. It starts with feeding the cow, then milking the cow, then boiling the milk. There are so many processes involved. They are important, no doubt. But if you get so lost in the processes that in the end, the final result is not butter, then none of those things are of any avail. So he puts this disclaimer right in the beginning. He says the entire thing is like the churning, is like the process of preparing butter. The ultimate thing is the butter, which in this case is moksha mukti, is becoming one with the Lord. That is the most important. So keeping that in mind, you can now listen to the different 10 common characteristics of all the Puranas.
And this is actually a very, very important thing, because, of course, the 18 Puranas, as Shuka Maharshi was saying, I think, did we mention that of all the Puranas, there are 18, he says, which actually are the real Puranas, which were compiled and presented by Vyasa. And that's why I think Swami also says that Ashtadasha Purana Ishu, that's what Vyasa says in the end, that help ever, hurt never, is the essence of all these Puranas. So of all these Puranas, I think these we can be clear of. You know, these are Puranas validated by none other than Vyasa. But even
and
the
Swami now.
Right, by Swami, and the other stories which you come across, as you're saying that we'll read so many other stories, we will read fables from other cultures also. What is important is, at the end of that reading or end of that study, is it leading to this? Is it leading to you turning inward? Is it leading somewhere, at least, you know, if not the entire journey, at least one step closer to that journey? Then it is serving the purpose of what a Purana is supposed to serve, even if it is not a Purana. And that's why these qualities which he mentions are very, very important. And that idea that eventually it should give that butter in the end, if that is not achieved, even if if it does the partial work, there is a danger of it being incomplete, and when something is incomplete, it can actually misdirect you.
Dear listeners, we'll take a quick little break now. On the other side of the break, we will try to go through all the 10 of the common characteristics of all the Puranas. Otherwise, we will go through as much as we can and leave the rest for the next week.
Ni తత్పదం చింతయేయం సదా భావయామి గోపాల బాలం మన సేవితం తత్పదం చింతయేయం సదా.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We're talking about the beautiful description which Shukra Maharshi gives Parikshit when he asks him what's a Purana. After telling him about the 18 primary Puranas, he says that a Purana is meant to have certain qualities which identify them as Puranas. He says, I think Upapuranas also are there, right? The smaller Puranas, but he says that they have about 5 attributes, but the real Puranas which are worthy of worship literally are those that have 10 qualities.
And those 10 are, just listing them out: Sarga, Visarga, Sthana, Poshana, Uti, Manvantara, Ishanucharita, Nirodha, Mukti and Ashraya. And Swami states that Ashraya is the most important of all these 10. But we'll quickly try to go through these 10. The first is Sarga, which can be loosely defined as elemental creation. So, in the beginning, the 3 gunas, that is Sattva, Rajas and Tamas, they are in harmony. They are in absolute harmony, and that is what is called as Prakriti, or the primeval substance, or the Mula. And that is why, you know, God is called as the Mula Dhara. He is the basis of the Mula. So, this is called the Mula. And when there is a disturbance of this, the 3 gunas which are in harmony, which is also called as Prakriti or Mula, when there is a disturbance, it gives rise to the 5 elements, which is earth, water, fire, air and space. And these 5 elements have their 5 subtle attributes, or the tanmatras, which is sound, touch, taste, smell and sight, yeah, vision. You can see, for example, akasha or space, you can only hear it. Then the next comes fire which you can, and the next comes air, sorry, yeah, akasha, space, then is air is something you can hear as well as feel, that's all,
right.
You can hear and feel it. Then comes fire, which you can hear, feel and see. Then comes water, which you can hear, feel, see and
touch.
Earth, along with all this, you can also taste,
right.
You can smell it. So this is how, from subtle to gross, the 5 tanmatras, that is the subtle attributes of the 5 elements, come. And along with, so this is 5 plus 5, 10, and along with this also come the 5 jnanendriyas, which is nothing but these 5 senses,
right.
Smell, touch, taste, the 5 jnanendriyas, along with the mind. So these 16 together are called as Sarga, and they arise because of the disturbance in the harmony of the 3 gunas.
Right. Actually, the way it is beautifully explained by Swami, I think, in one of his discourse, he says, you know, you're talking of the absolute. You're talking about the state where, that's what he says, this happens even before the beginning of time. Because he makes a point that time was also created in this process.
In this disturbance.
In this disturbance. Time even did not exist. And he says in that absolute state, he does not create another entity immediately. He creates attributes for himself. The attributeless becomes knowable through attributes. That's what they say. That first he creates that akasha. When you say akasha, it's not the space that we see. It is the ability to hear this attributeless. So this attributeless adorns this attribute of being heard. And that's why Swami says Pranava is the first form of divinity. If when the formless becomes form, gets a form, it's Pranava. It's the sound of Omkara.
Mm.
And so it slowly takes on some of these attributes. It can be heard. Next it can be felt. Next it can be seen. Then it can also be touched. And all of these attributes are taken. That's why these are called tanmatras. These are not like the gross elements. And Swami says that these come out of the sattvaguna. So sattvaguna produces the tanmatras. And then, of course, there is a beautiful, Swami gives a full equation of how it happens. the process of Panchikritam, Swami says, mm-hmm. that, you know, one quarter of this and one quarter of that and one quarter of that with one eighth, and it's a long process. And then Swami explains it through, you know, if you have 1 rupee, it has got 8 anas. So you take 4 anas from one element and take one ana from the other elements, then you get the gross air, then you get the gross earth, Swami says. And for this process, you need the rajas and tamas to come in. So Swami says, in all this process, you have the physical world, which is a perfect balance of sattva, rajas and tamas. And when there is disturbance in this, I think this is something else again, in the earlier part he explains, when there is a disturbance in creation, dharma is not fostered, that's when the avatar steps into the whole creation.
Perfect, perfect. In fact, in my understanding, the way I understood this is, the 15 are formed because these 5 things are there, that is sound, hearing and smelling and touching, tasting, all these. So it is like the experiencer, the experienced and the experience, these 3. So 5 into these 3 becomes 15 plus the mind, that is 16. So all this come under sarga, which is the elemental creation. Now, you know, in chemistry also we would have come across this process wherein when we are running a reaction, we are very careful as to the amounts of each substance we add. Because what will otherwise happen is, once the reaction gets complete, the new product that is formed, if some of the old reactants are left, the new product will react with the old reactants and form a, you know, a secondary new product. That way it goes on. And here, visarga actually refers to secondary creation. And this secondary creation comes when the above 16, you know, that is the 555 plus the mind, these 16 begin to interact with the 3 gunas. The 3 gunas themselves came because of the disturbance, and that disturbance led to the creation of these 16. But those 3 gunas still exist. So this 16 interact with the 3 gunas and lead to further creation. That is what is known as the visarga.
Right. And let's not forget, if we are losing track, these are all attributes of Puranas. Mm-hmm. We'll come back to how these are attributes of Puranas. Then the third point which he speaks about is sthana. He says that everything that is in this created world has a certain place, has a certain limit. There are boundaries within which it must exist. And this definition of these boundaries is what this sthana stands for. And Swami would often say this, the body is a limited company. It has, if it is overused, if it is any sense is used more than it has to be used in a manner inappropriately to what it is prescribed to be used as, that's when the whole confusion begins. So that sthana, that what is the propriety of each of the elements in this creation and what it has to do, that is what is referred to in this attribute of sthana.
And also, you know, sthana also is like translated as the places.
Places, right.
And it is, at a lowest form, it is like the geographical place. In one way, for example, you can take it like the sthana of an earthworm is underground, the sthana of human is above ground, all that. But in a very subtle manner, the sthana refers to the different worlds. And the 14 lokas are described from Patala below to the Brahmaloka that is above. And when we say below and above, it is more like the energy states in an atom. It's not location-wise below and above, but different stages of evolution. The highest evolved and at a highest kind of energy state is the Brahmaloka. At the lowest is the Patala. So these are more or like states of existence rather than the actual place of existence. So in the Puranas we come across all these states. We come across things or people or beings or occurrences in the Patala and all these also in the Brahmaloka. So the Puranas encompass all these 14 worlds, and that is described by the word sthana. The next attribute is poshana. Poshana means sustenance. And Swami beautifully explains that this sustenance again depends on the level. For the lowest form of sustenance is the material sustenance, that is food. That is how creation gets sustained. But the highest form of sustenance is protection of the beings from the illusion of Maya. That is what a spiritual aspirant seeks most. That is why we read in the Purana stories of people like Dhruva, who who give up food, drink and even air. They stop breathing also because their yearning for the highest is so high. I mean, their intensity is so much. So therefore, it is not as if food sustains everybody or air sustains everybody. Therefore, Swami says that at the lowest level, poshana or sustenance is food, but at the highest level, it is protection and freedom from the illusion of maya.
And then probably before we go forward, how are these actually related to the Puranas? That's how it is. The first two points, if we look at, it's about how the creation comes about, how the variety comes about. And when we were going through the Ramakatha Raswayani, I think one discourse clip which we played and something which Swami repeated during the 1996 Samukos is, Swami would say the entire Ramayana is nothing but a play of the three gunas. Swami would say it is nothing to show to you what the three gunas can make you do. And Swami would, say how, you know, the three women that Lord Rama sees before he meets Mother Sita, including Mother Sita, that is, I think the first is Tataki, then is Ahalya, and then is Sita. Again, they represent Tamas, Rajas, and Sattva. Then he talks about the three mothers being a representation of Tamas, Rajas, and Sattva. Then he talks about, Vali, brothers. Sugriva, and Hanuman as Rajas, Tamas, Rajas, and Sattva. So,
and the three brothers, and the three Ravana, brothers, Ravana,
Kumbhakarna, Vibhishana. And Swami would say that entire Ramayana in different places shows you how what is the response of the Lord to the three gunas, and how do you manage these three gunas to get the grace of the Lord? Because it's not that everybody was a absolute representation of only that guna. Swami would also say that, you know, at this point, this is the influence which he is representing. And that is why this point, the first two points of Sarga and Visarga, which is like how the creation has come to be, that keeps playing out again and again in our life. You know, that is how we keep reacting. Every moment, Swami would say, every day is like a new creation. And that creation is based on the way the three gunas play and how you express that in your everyday life and decisions. And then, of course, the sthana and poshana, as Swami was saying, that, you know, what is the progress that happens in life that is again shown in this, in all these stories, as you were saying, sthana, the 14 lokas. So many of these stories are like this. He did this and he reaches this loka, and Bali Chakravarti goes to, you know, the loka below the earth. All of this is again to show that what happens when you do something, what is the place that you get, that, you know, Dhruvaya becomes a star, you know,
the highest.
What does he aspire for? What does he get? So all of this is coded, and that's why these are all attributes of Puranas, because these are the different topics which are covered in the Puranas.
And then comes Uti. Uti is defined as the creative impetus. What is this? I mean, if you look at the whole creation as, like, we have used the analogy of a drama. Now, in the drama also, when we have things going on, we define characteristics, we define, so that is like the gunas. We define each person's characteristics. Now, based on the characteristics, each person responds and each person acts, each being, each thing in the creation does something. And when it does something, again, based on the three gunas, the mixture that is there, the response is in some manner. So, all this is governed by that kind of intrinsic rules. So, those rules, the impetus for action as well as the consequences of action, that is defined by the term Uti. And Swami says that the true impetus for the living entity should be to reach back the source from which it has come, that is the Godhead. So, any other impetus will lead to different kind of results, reactions, and what Swami would often say as Punarapi Jananam, Punarapi Maranam. So, it's almost like the practical term for describing Uti can possibly be the karma theory and the way karma and its effects
and, I mean, proceed. It's like when you're looking at a story, going back to the analogy of a drama, when you're seeing a drama, seeing a film, that underlying logic, you know, sometimes when you see these serials which run over many months and years on television, you would see that some of those irrational serials, the character itself changes. The nature of the character changes. That's when your logic is falling apart in your screenplay. When you talk of Uti, the beauty of these Puranas is even if a person is bad, there is actually a history behind why he becomes like that.
There's
a logic for that. If you see the Mahabharata, there's an explanation why Pandu behaves in a certain way, why Dhritarashtra behaves in a certain way, what is the source of Vidura's nobility. There is a sequence for everything, even for Ravana and Vibhishana, why they are different. Of course, when we are telling the story of Ramayana and Mahabharata, we highlight only the main plot. But there are actually stories in the Puranas for all of this. That is the essence of that Uti concept.
And actually, Prem, when we go through the entire thing, if we sincerely go through and see everything, we will stop praising somebody, we will stop demeaning somebody. We are just lost in admiration for the screenplay.
Yeah, absolutely. That's all. Just like how we were going through the character of Karna and Arjuna, the moment you go to the previous lifetime of both of them, the Naranarayana episode and
Sahasra Kavach.
I mean, it's a completely different. I mean, so there is no character who is, I mean, he's a bad character, just accept it. The Puranas never do that. There's always a source for that person's nobility. There's always a source for that person's, unacceptable behavior too. And that is what is represented by this concept of Uti.
And of course, any drama, any play definitely needs to have time. The time is one more aspect, and we described how in the beginning there was no time also. You know, it's not like it, all this happened even before the time began, because time itself is a
byproduct of this
entire disturbance. So Manvantara, it literally translates into change of manus, and the reason that it is called change of manus is because it is believed that creation has as its first being Swayambhuva Manu. Swayambhuva meaning one who is born from oneself.
Nice.
Because in the beginning, if there's nobody, how can somebody give birth to somebody? So Swayambhuva Manu is the first Manu. And it is Manu who codifies everything. We have Manu Dharma, we have everything. He sets the rules, everything, and then sets the ball rolling for creation to proceed. And with the end of that cycle, when the Pralaya happens, that Manu cycle is ended. And the cycle of another new Manu begins. So each cycle of this Manu is called the age of Manu and the Manvantara. So that is the description for why the term Manvantara has come. But Manvantara basically is reference to the time aspect.
Right. And it is so categorically given, you know, how many, what constitutes a day, what constitutes a month, what constitutes a year, and how many such years make a yuga, how many such yugas make this entire kalpa. And that is given, and that time frame, you know, again, going back to the analogy of seeing a drama, sometimes that is what, if there is no logic when it comes to the time frame of that drama, that again will actually upset us. And sometimes that's what happens even when you're reading the Ramayana, when we are not able to perceive how that time is actually distributed. We are not able to relate to the idea. You know, when Swami would say that Krishna lived for 125 years and at the point of war, they were different ages. I mean, the very fact that all those details are given is there is this fabric of time very, very logically placed on which the story is created. And that will always take you back to this whole idea of creation.
And, you know, that becomes very important. For example, if we take the thing about movies or dramas also, you will see, for instance, that one moment where there is intense joy or intense pain, it is possibly depicted in your drama for about 5 minutes.
Right.
It's just 2 seconds. But then in movies, you will see a child is riding the cycle and it fades into a guy riding a bike and coming.
Right.
And we are supposed to know that 30 years have passed.
Right.
So, unless we know that, if that one thing is cut out, you know, of the child going on the cycle and transforming into a guy coming on a bike, if that one part is cut out, I'm sure the entire logic will collapse. Therefore, this aspect of time is very important when the previous, to support the previous thing that we described, the aspect of logic.
Right.
So, therefore, the concept of Manvantara comes, and, you know, Swami writes in the Bhagavata Vahini how one human year is equivalent to one day for the gods, and 360 such days becomes one year for the gods, and 1000 such years is the Kali Yuga, 2000 such years is Dwapara Yuga, 3000 such years of the gods is Treta Yuga, and 4000 god years is Satya Yuga. And but it doesn't end with that. Swami says that each yuga has 200, 400, 600 or 800 contact periods, also called sandhya periods. And 12,000 such years comprise one Mahayuga. And 1,000 such Mahayugas form a single day for Brahma. And every day Brahma is seeing 14 Manus. which means each Manu is a master of more than 70 Mahayugas. In short, everything is just mind-boggling and, you know, time scales are phenomenal. Right. It is like trying to make a water bubble on the surface of water, try to understand the Jurassic era, the Triassic era, and the Paleozoic era. It is incomprehensible because the time frame of that water bubble on water is just a few milliseconds.
Right. And, you know, this is something which probably we have grown up with. The idea that Brahma's one day is, you know, equal to so many thousands of years. But, you know, now when you see something like a movie like the Interstellar, which is completely based on physics and the gravitational forces and the way black holes work and all that, they say that you go into a dimension which is a little higher. There actually you spend one day, it's equal to 12 years in the Earth. I mean, that's how they show that movie, and it is actually completely based in science. It's not a fictitious thing. Though nobody has experienced it, they know from mathematical equations that that's how those time frames should be. I mean, when we see it, we know it. When the Puranas speak about a possibility such as that, that the Devas are living in a dimension where their one day is much, much, much longer than, you know, our one day, which is like a blip in their time frame. So that, I mean, the beauty is Puranas talk of all of these things. And they give the complexity, and from that, again, comes down to the essence, and they give you stories which can be completely easily related to.
You know, on a lighter note, I was just thinking, I am living more in the present than Brahma. Because for Brahma, living in a present might be just living in these 10 million years. For me, living in the present is more.
It is much more pinpoint.
More pinpointed. Do we have time to go through the next four characteristics, or since the time in our studio?
I think we'll have to continue that in the next week, because it'll also be heavy, I guess. You know, to be this particular part was a bit heavy, where it's all about the essence of creation, which I recall in another discourse, Swami gives this analogy. Swami would say, you, one person being born again and again, doing karmas and being born again, is like a seed. You plant a seed, you get a tree. That tree gives forth so many more seeds. And each of those seed, when you plant, you get another tree. And, you know, that process is so long. So Swami says in that, what is the point in taking a seed and trying to find out who is the grandfather of the seed? That's a whole different and difficult exercise altogether. Swami says, if you put it in your mouth and chew, that seed will not give another tree henceforth. And Swami says, that is the opportunity which you have now. Don't ask, where is your source? You know, who was your grandfather? Before this, which birth I was in? Before that birth, where I was? Swami says, that's futile, because that will not lead you anywhere. Swami says, right now, try to find out how to put an end to the cycle that you have entered. And that is an exercise which is worthwhile. And the Puranas are like that. You know, if you go into that, you'll get lost. And that's why probably this part was so heavy for us, because it's a concept which the mind actually cannot comprehend. You know, how much ever we try to explain and try to explain to ourselves and the listeners, it's not going to be easy to comprehend.
But all said and done, Prem, you know, when I actually was reading all this, first time when I read through, it was really very complicated. I understood nothing, and I was actually wondering, what on earth will I speak in the afternoon satsang? But two readings, three readings later, and I must say that there is a kind of intellectual joy.
Right.
Though it is something beyond the mind, there is definitely some joy even at the level of the intellect and mind when we read this and understand. If not anything else, it just gives us the feeling that, you know, there is something that is far bigger, far magnificent, and much, much huge compared to us. It humbles us. It makes us less egoistic. You know, it makes us think less about ourselves. If not anything else, this in itself is a great benefit that we can enjoy. And once again, the reason for all this benefit is our beloved Bhagwan, who has done all that he has done in our lives. We are grateful to him for this opportunity. We shall forever be. Yes, dear listeners, if you have any doubts, I don't know if we can answer those doubts, but anyway, any of your thoughts, your feedback, everything is welcome. You can write to us at listener@radiosci.org. We hope that you felt as enlightened as we felt when we went to the Bhagavata Vahini. We'll now end with a song, on the other side of which you will be joined by Brother Chandu with his segment Love to Love.
Do 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 do. వెలుగుతేవే జాబిల్లి రావే జాజి పూలు తేవే మనసుకనే చలిసి నోడే మన కొరకై వచ్చినాడే కాలమే వేణువై తీయగా
Thank you.